It's getting to be the time of year where I'm starting to have a lot more commitments than I anticipated, and as a result, we're going to have to pare the podcast down a little. I did something like this last year, and now we're coming back to it again. Not sure for how long, but just temporary for now. So you'll still have 3 episodes this month, this week, next week, and the week after that. We'll be pausing the Short Story Book Club for some time, so no episode at the end of the month. And then in August, we'll be going to every other week for your interview episodes. And we'll be staying on that schedule for a little while until, you know, things pick up again and I have a little more time and energy to devote to the show. But now that that's all out of the way, let's turn our attention to Morgan Talty as he talks about his book Night of the Living Res and about The Lesser Blessed by Richard Van Camp. Welcome to Your Favorite Book. And so let's jump right into it. So you've got a book coming out. And so can you tell us a little bit about yourself as a writer and about this book?
Yeah, so I was born in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and I moved to the Penobscot Indian Nation when I was 6 with my mother. And I grew up there. I'm Penobscot. My mom's Penobscot. And I've been was never really a reader or a writer growing up. I started writing later when I was about 18. And I sort of started writing nonfiction, more memoir type stuff. And then I started to gravitate toward fiction because I found myself in moments where I was like, it'd be cool if this actually had happened. and so I sort of moved into writing fiction. And, you know, after, you know, so many years of writing, I was able to complete this first book of stories called Night of the Living Res, which comes out Tuesday, July 5th. And it's set on the Penobscot Nation, and it's comprised of 12 stories, and they're all told by the same narrator, but at different points in time. So there are some stories narrated by a boy named David, and in other stories that are narrated by David as well, but he's older and he goes by the name of Dee. And each story stands alone, but all together they sort of offer this narrative arc about sort of family and like what had happened. And it's really a book about, you know, there's a lot of tragedy in it, but it's really about how do these characters go past that and are able to forgive and love and care for each other, you know, given all of the faults that they have and all of the bad things that have happened.
I think that's a great way to put it, and actually leads right into my first question about your book. And the structure of it stood out to me sort of immediately. You know, you have your novels and then you have your more straightforward short story collections where maybe there's a setting that's sort of continuous across them, but normally different characters, and we don't have recurring narrators quite as often. But you have very much, as you mentioned, the same narrator, the same protagonist, and then often very similar characters who pop in and out, his family, his friends, things like that. And then they span, you know, this large stretch of time, and they're also non-linear in how they're organized. They kind of go back and forth between adulthood and childhood at various points. And so I'm curious to know, you know, tell me about this structure. Do you know, did it start off with one story and then you just had more to learn about these characters? Like, how did that all start for you?
Yeah, I didn't find this structure until very late in the process. You know, I'm not a planner when it comes to writing. I mean, I am at a certain degree, but not in the beginning. And to be honest, this, you know, the first story I actually wrote for the collection is the title story, Night of the Living Res, which is the second to last story in the book. And I wrote that in 2015 as just a story. I had no plans to do anything else with it or to explore those characters anymore. But I found myself writing a couple other stories from David's perspective. And it wasn't until I went into my MFA program that I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to write a story collection. And I was like, I've been working with these characters, this character, David. And up to that point, I had only written Night of the Living Res and a couple other David stories, as well as Smoke's Last. That was the only one pre-MFA that made it into the book. And so I was like, all right, my parameters will be is I'll start with David as a boy and I'll just move all the way until he's, you know, an adult in Night of the Living Res. And so that's what I did. And I ended up writing like 15 or 16 stories from just solely from David's perspective. And then I put them all together and they moved chronologically, and I looked at it and I was like, this is terrible. This is just like, would not be a fun read, because, you know, you had mentioned, you know, story collections usually share that, you know, they may have like a similar setting or like a thematic similarity among, you know, across the stories, but they're usually different characters, different situations. And this was the same character over and over again, except he was just getting older, and there just seemed no point to it. So I was like, well, whatever, maybe this doesn't work. So I just stopped and I was like, I'm going to write something else. And I wrote what became Burn. And when I was writing Burn, I wanted to name the character David, because I had written so much from his perspective. So I just put D, the letter D, in as a placeholder. And when I was revising, I was like, well, what is his name? What is his name? And I was convinced it had to start with a D. So I just put two E's after it. And like, once I did that, I was like, wait, is this David? Like, is David going by D now? Is he much older? And then I was like, yes, that's it. And then the question became, what happened? And so then I had this whole other like time period to write in for these characters. And I started, you know, churning out these D narratives with D and Phyllis. And before I knew it, I had these D narratives that were all standalone, really, except I think they had more of an emotional arc to them, or in the same way that David stories do too. But, you know, it wasn't until I had written those that I was like, oh, okay, now there's some interesting stuff happening here, not just in the stories, but structurally, emotionally, as it occurs over the span of the 12 stories. And, you know, the David stories were easy to order because they moved chronologically. There was very little I could do to move them out of order. But the D stories had no time markers. They had nothing that identified them as having to precede or, you know, come before one another. And so I just was like, well, what is the most emotional, like, what's the emotional arc here? And for me, it started with Burn, and then, you know, it went to Get Me Some Medicine, and then it kept going and going all the way to Earth Speak, where there's that final moment that is sort of like that final like leap that D takes to sort of come back to life as sort of the central question of the book asks, you know, like how do the living come back to life if they're not even dead? And so it was really a really organic process. Like, I just followed the story, you know, I just tried to listen to what the story wanted for as long as I could hear it. And then when it stopped talking to me, I was kind of like, oh, well, I think this is it. I think it's done.
I love this like creative, chaotic energy you're bringing to this. You know, I've talked to plenty of writers who are like, I came in with an outline and I had this whole arc planned. And you're like, you know what? I'm just going to let the stories tell me where I'm going. And I'm just going to figure out the arc. And I'm just going to focus on what seems fun and engaging to read. And, you know, at its core, that's kind of what creating a story is all about, you know, just following your instincts and appealing to what you like as a reader. And so it's nice to see that kind of process also find its way here. And this is deviating a little bit from my questions, but I'm just curious, maybe it's because I'm in the process of creating MFA applications myself, but tell me about your MFA program. You know, how do you think that helped you creatively, hindered you, you know, brought you along? What was that like for you?
Yeah, so I went to the Stone Coast MFA, which is a low residency program through the University of Southern Maine. And I actually serve on the faculty there now, which is very cool. But I loved the low residency MFA. I had spent 3 years at a community college after high school, and then I spent 4 years doing my undergraduate at Dartmouth College. So that was like 7 years for an undergrad degree. And at the end of that, I was just tired. I was like, I'm sick of cafeterias. I don't want to live in dorm rooms. You know, I'm done with that. And so I applied to the low residency program because all you had to do was attend two 10-day residencies twice a year or once a year. Yeah, once a year, two times. And then you would work one-on-one with a mentor in between those residencies. And I found it more sort of in tune with what I consider a writing life to be for a lot of people, where you are not, you know, you're not surrounded constantly by writers and artists, right? You're living a life, you know, you're at home, you have a job. And it taught me discipline, really. It helped me sort of create understand my process for writing and how to go about it. And plus, I just had fantastic mentors, you know, who were so smart and believed in me and, you know, gave me the best advice and teaching that they could.
Mm-hmm. I this gives me like so much reassurance because I'm also applying to low residency programs.
Oh, and cool.
I haven't gotten to speak to anyone who's gone to a low res program. It's all the traditional programs. And I'm like, you know what? It'd be really great too. And here you are. So that's a vote of confidence. I apologize, everyone, for the digression, but I needed to know. Coming back to your collection a little bit, there is one line here in one of your stories, and I have it bookmarked. And let me see which story this was. This is in Safe Harbor. And in Safe Harbor, there's the narrator is talking about his mom and basically describing how she's dressed and how she looks. And it says, but nothing makes her look young. She's Native and she has trauma. So do I. I'm the one who saw it. But she thinks she is more. She doesn't say that, but she thinks it. Maybe she's right. Maybe older Natives have more trauma than younger ones. And that line really stuck with me because it got me to think, you know, I can speak to this from my perspective. I'm Indian American, and in a lot of Indian American literature, there's kind of this, you know, set of problems, so to speak, that first generation people have, and this set of problems that second generation people have, and so on and so forth, almost a trope, if you will. You don't see that, I'm assuming, you don't see that same kind of delineation with Native communities, but I'm curious to know, what do you think are some of the main differences that a younger generation of Native people face compared to their parents and grandparents? And is it possible to say that one group has more or less trauma than another?
I think in some instances, definitely, it's safe to say that one era has more trauma than another. I think it'd be very hard to, you know, I think that's what Dee's problem there is he can't really reconcile whether or not, you know, the trauma his mother experienced is equal or greater than the trauma he experienced. And I think, you know, one of the things I always consider is that, you know, young Native people, you know, are experiencing trauma in certain ways in the same way that, you know, non-Native young people are experiencing trauma, right? We think about addiction and poverty, mm-hmm. and any form of sort of violence that has been cast out by, you know, colonialism. So there's this shared trauma that I feel like this younger generation has, but then there's also this, I think, you know, intergenerational trauma, you know, this blood memory that people mm-hmm. carry, right? You know, that just because it didn't happen to us doesn't mean we don't experience it in some way. Like it wasn't passed down to mm-hmm. us. I can't remember the article, but there was like this study they did with mice, and they had these mice in a cage, and they would spray this like I'm probably getting all the details wrong, but they would spray this like cherry perfume, and like they'd spray that and the mice would smell it, and then they'd get a little shock to their feet. And they kept doing that until mm-hmm. the mice realized that every time that smell came, that meant they were going to get shocked on their feet. So they would jump. They would, you know, they would try to avoid it. And then when those mice had children, those baby mice, they had never been exposed to that experiment. But when they smelled the smell, they still jumped. So they had inherited from their parents this, you know, this trauma that they had actually gone through. And so it's like in one way, there's new trauma that is, you know, this younger generation has. But then there's also that transitioned, you know, intergenerational trauma that also gets carried in our DNA that we have to mm-hmm. somehow grapple with. And so I feel like it's hard to say if one, you know, I feel like there are definitely Indigenous people out there whose life experiences have been just extremely rough, right? And then there are some who have not, you know. But I still think, you know, there's that element of, you know, what's it called? Intergenerational trauma still, you know, connected to them, regardless of how well they've grown up.
That makes a lot of sense, honestly. And you're right. I mean, regardless if your family or immigrating or just, you know, if you're in an in-group, I feel like almost every writer I've spoken to recently has had some commentary on intergenerational trauma. I mean, we're seeing it in our Disney movies. Like, it's really becoming something that we all are starting to recognize and experience and really bring to life in our literature. And I love that you brought DNA into this. You're bringing together my two very special interests, books and DNA. I'm a genetic counselor. So these are the things I do with my day-to-day life. But getting back to the book, essentially, this is maybe not a fully formed thought, but reading so many of these stories from David / Dee's perspective, and then also reading The Lesser Blessed, so I guess this will transition well over to that, it got me thinking a lot about, you know, the benefits and the limitations of a male experience, especially when we're writing, when there's so much around female characters. I'm thinking about David's mom, about Paige, and then in Lesser Blessed, I'm thinking about Juliet. I keep wondering, you know, how well we can write these, I guess thinking about the traumas they're experiencing too, you know, those added identities of, you know, being female and then also being marginalized in that respect as well. And I guess I don't really have a question here at the end of this. It's just more me thinking out loud, but I'm curious to know how you approached sort of writing these characters that are a little more outside yourself and, you know, treating them with the respect that you did.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad they came across as, you know, good, you know, that I didn't do or create any sort of, you know, misery porn with these Native women. I think, I mean, I grew up mostly around women, you know, my mom, my sister, on my mom's side, she had all sisters. So I had three aunts. I had cousins that were girls. And I don't know. I just always felt this like sense of security and safety around women. I mean, my mother was a huge like force in my life. And mm-hmm. I just always sort of respected her and I respected, you know, women. And it was just, I feel like that experience for me just sort of translated in a good way to the book, I think. But that's not to say, you know, that's not to say my upbringing did not, you know, consist of the normal, or not the normal. Yeah, I guess the normal, the bad parts of, you know, quote unquote masculinity, right. Mm-hmm. You know, how men treat women.
Right.
But, I think what I found really striking when writing this book, cause it's obvious, like you said, it's written through the perspective of a man and a boy, is I think, you know, in a lot of literature, I very rarely see male characters with female characters, you know, and having male characters be seen as powerless in a lot of situations. Like men, obviously, you know, this is a patriarchal society and men hold the position of power, but there's like still this like sliver of inability to act as, you know, as like a boy, as like a young adult. And it's, you know, especially when it comes to violence and stuff, and we think about what these boys, what boys see and might see growing up in certain settings. But, you know, I was always interested in, you know, what is this powerlessness that, you know, is in masculinity, if that's the right word to use here. You know, how, you know, like, what is it? Like, I'm not really interested in being like, okay, what does it mean to be a man? You know, like, I'm more interested in like, what does it mean to be a good human being? Right. But I think to ask that question, we have to somehow grapple with the questions of masculinity and like gender roles. And in order to get out of that, you know, confined societal box that's been constructed. I think just writing them, it was really just me trying to just, I guess, level the playing field when at most moments. Right. And, you know, showing the good and the bad of these characters, but then also not forgetting that they're influenced by, you know, societal constructs that, would influence mm-hmm. how they acted and how they behaved.
That definitely encapsulates it well. And I mean, you're right. You write from the lens that you experience and that you exhibit, and even if you're trying to get at something larger, we write from our context, and it takes sort of understanding that context to really get at something from a larger picture. And I think you put that really well. And I think that whole idea of powerlessness in masculinity, that ties in even more well to The Lesser Blessed, which we can transition over to. So that's the book you picked for this episode. So The Lesser Blessed by Richard Van Camp. It's a book I had never heard of before. I had never even seen it. Thankfully, my library had it. And this was an interesting read. This was a tough read for sure. Not in terms of length. It's a very short book, but in terms of subject matter for anyone who hasn't read this book. We're no strangers to tough reads on this show, but I think what hit me especially hard about this book is that there are just so many wrongs inflicted on so many people, and there's no one in particular to hold accountable. It's kind of this anti-YA book where in YA you have this like specific targetable villain and then this like achievable comeuppance that you can get. And instead here, the villain is just the how this society is built and socioeconomic status and what it means to be marginalized and things you can't actively fight against. And that powerlessness really comes through. But before we dive on that even more, Morgan, I'm interested in knowing, you know, tell me about when you first read this book and what your thoughts were.
Yeah, so I encountered this, I think, in 2011. This is when I was studying at the community college. I did this 5-week exploring transfer program at Vassar College. And one of the TAs there, who was a graduating undergraduate at Vassar, before I left, he gave me a copy of this book called The Lesser Blessed. He knew I was Native and Penobscot. And, you know, I read it, you know, coming home. And because, like you said, it's not a very long read at all. It's quite short. But I just remember being just so blown away by it, and being like, you can write in this way. You know what I mean? Like, you could do this stuff. You can talk about these things. And there was just something, you know, this is one of the few books that I can reread and be like, and still see something new in it. And it was just so powerful. I just loved everything about it. It was just such an emotional ride of a book, you know, and it was like convinced me, you know, oh, when I write, I need to try to create this sort of emotion for the reader. And you know, this was published in 1991, and I feel like, I feel like this book was ahead of its time in a way. You know, hearing you talk about, you know, what is the antagonist here, right? Like who do we hold accountable in this book for what goes wrong? And I feel like we're in a specific point in time where we can read a book like this and be like, oh, this is because of colonialism. This is because of, you know, state violence. You know, this is because of, you know, X, Y, and Z. You know, I feel like readers have a much more rich vocabulary and approach to reading now. You know, it used to, I'm not going to say used to, but I feel like reading literature used to be like just you and the text, and like what you see there is what you have to make of it. But this book, I just feel like it has this sort of like timeless element to it. And I feel like I had known it was published in 91, but just today when I was looking at it again, I was like, really? It was published that long ago? Like, it just still feels new.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. I didn't actually look at the publication date, and I'm surprised too, now that you're telling me that it was 1991, I definitely felt newer in many respects, but at the same time, it kind of calls back to a slightly older style of book. I think almost of like The Outsiders, in the way you hear like that casual kind of dialogue and obviously a very tense, violent atmosphere. But at the same time, The Outsiders is written without that colonial lens. It's about white people. And here we're getting something. And I'm glad you bring up kind of that old world idea, a very Eurocentric idea of literary criticism, where it's like you and the symbolism and what's explicitly on the page, and you can't bring in anything else. But I feel like no writer, especially BIPOC writers, are writing without societal context in their stories. And to ignore that is ignoring like at least half of what the criticism exists. So
you definitely
can't read this book with that lens, that old lens.
Yeah, you definitely need to read it, you know, outside of its own context. Like, it's just, it just has to be read that way. And I feel like you can read it also within its own context. It's just one of those books that is like, from all angles, there's something something sparkling about it, even with all the grim and, you know, dark stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, starting along that line, I think you can start with Larry himself. So Larry is kind of our speaker through this book. He's our guide. And his narrative voice is certainly really unique, and it kind of anchors the whole book, getting everything through his perspective. It's certainly unnerving. Like, definitely Larry reminded me that I never want to be a teenager ever again. just brought me back to that time in life. And I'm like, yeah, I'm really happy being an adult woman and not a teenage girl in high school, because I don't need to deal with that. But at the same time, you get a lot of Larry's, I think the coolest thing that Richard Van Camp did here is showing how Larry is constantly masking. He's constantly hiding the obvious trauma that he's faced. And it's kind of worming its way into the narrative. Obviously, to tell everything is a big spoiler, but it's worming its way in, but he's doing so much work all the time to keep that in and to keep that hidden, you know, sacrificing his own emotional and physical well-being. He's making it seem like his teenage problems are the only problems he's ever faced, and that everything's actually pretty okay when they're not. And the way Van Camp is able to do that, I just thought made this book so tense and so real.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting is because, you know, when we think of first person narration, you know, there's always that distinction between the character and the narrator, who is also the character, right? And, you know, I feel like mm-hmm. that distinction, that separation, you know, disappears or can disappear in fiction that's leaning more towards young adult. But here, you know, like it's like you said, like there's so much work being done throughout the book, you know, like the use of parentheses when we get like mm-hmm. snippets of Larry saying something. We don't really know to who, to the reader, to, you know, in his mind, to the character in that moment. And it just also like stylistically is super cool and interesting looking. But it also just shows, like you said, this sort of like detached. How do you say it? He's just sort of detached from the moment, even though he's there.
Right. Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, that detachment, you know, it ties into this just tone of hopelessness we get in this book, right? So there's this initial early scene where they're in a classroom, and the teachers have all checked out, and like, nobody's really expecting to do anything or to graduate even. And Van Camp kind of avoids a lot of the obvious tropes here. He avoids having like the one straight A student character that's going to find their way out and going to make something of themselves. There's no kind of obvious, you know, American capitalist work hard and you'll inherit the earth kind of mindset. It is characters who are in a situation and they're really not going to get out of it, at least not in the way we want them to. And you just have to live with that. And it's dismal to think of, but it leads you to also empathize with characters that would otherwise be thought of as straightforward villains, like Darcy or Johnny, and characters you don't really like, but you get them because they're all trapped in this same kind of atmosphere.
Exactly, exactly.
I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot. It's such a short book, but there's so much on the page here to bring in. I mentioned how I felt about Juliet. My heart broke for Juliet like a million times. And my edition of the book, actually, I don't know if it's the same edition, has short stories in the book as well towards the end. And there's a short story that immediately takes on Juliet's perspective. And I was like shocked by that because we'd only been seeing Juliet through the eyes of Larry, a very leering teenage boy perspective. And now hearing Juliet's voice was almost shocking. You almost forget that she has a voice to begin with. And I mean, it's not an easy read by any means, everybody, but it doesn't mean it's not worth reading for sure.
Yeah. It is a tough read. And I have an older version, so I don't have the two stories in there, but I've read those two stories. It's such a good book. And even though it's so dark and grim, and there is still this sense of like hope in it, that these characters are mm-hmm. still, you know, going, you know, even when it ends. And I feel like that's super optimistic, even in the fact that Richard wrote those stories and decided to include them in, you know, the 20th year anniversary of the book, right? That says something mm-hmm. not about him, but also about the characters themselves, that you know, they still persisted.
For sure. And I think I'm glad you mentioned it was for the 20th anniversary, because my cover is actually the movie cover. There's apparently a movie. And have you seen the movie? Do you have any thoughts on the movie?
I have seen the movie. Yeah. And I saw it when I knew it was first coming out, I was like trying everything to get a copy of it. But it was in Canada and it was like just being shown in theaters and stuff. And I don't think I saw it until maybe, I feel like the movie came out in 2012, 2013. I don't think I saw it until a couple years later. It's always interesting. People who enjoy books versus the movie versus the book, you know, I love the book, you know, more than the movie. I think just because I had read it so long ago and I had read it so many times that I had in my mind, my own movie version of it, you know, and seeing it on the screen sort of cut against that, but it was still very good film. And I was glad to have finally seen it.
I'm glad you saw the movie, because I didn't know there was a movie till after I had finished the book. I'm not a huge movie person to begin with, but I guess the thing that was making me think, I was like, in some ways I could see this being, you know, a good movie. You could picture like those grimy party scenes, like really coming to life in a movie setting. But then I'm also thinking about like the prose work that Van Camp was doing with the parentheses, like you mentioned, all of that, that seems so subtle. I'm like wondering, you know, how does that translate to a movie? I know not all of it will directly translate, but those were just kind of the questions running through my mind.
Yeah, I think, you know, that was the biggest thing that I found that wasn't in the movie, but was felt in the book was, you know, this stylistic, you know, deliberate choice with language. Like you said, it must be so hard to transition or translate from book to screen. And it is that stylistic, it is that voice that really gives the book, you know, a good part of its life.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. You know, and for everybody listening, you know, if you're like me and you hadn't heard of this book, it's very short. It's definitely worth picking up. Just know that you're in for some tough subject matter, as we've mentioned here. You know, this isn't your happy-go-lucky kind of young people in high school kind of story, but I think you get that from hearing this conversation. But it's certainly a very unique piece of writing, to the point where I was trying to come up with, you know, a similar book that I'd recommend, and I couldn't really come up with anything. Like, a lot of books I read for young people are very much, you know, very different in tone. Like I mentioned The Outsiders, that might be the only thing I know of that even kind of approaches this kind of darkness. And that too, even that has kind of a campy West Side Story feel in hindsight. But Morgan, I'm interested in hearing from you. Do you have other books that you'd recommend for people who like The Lesser Blessed?
Yeah, I think the first one that comes to mind is Brandon Hobson's Where the Dead Sit Talking. I feel like that would
be... That's a good point.
I feel like, because like...
I forgot about that book.
Yeah, I didn't... You know, I've always thought of comparable titles for this, and I was like, I can never think of it. But when you started talking about that book came in my mind immediately. And Where the Dead Sit Talking is, I would never categorize it as a young adult novel. It's literary fiction. It's very, very good fiction. Mm-hmm. It was a National Book Award finalist. And I feel like, because that book deals with young characters, probably about Larry's age. And it is also has its dark moments. But I think that one would be pretty in line with The Lesser Blessed, I think.
Yeah, that's a really good suggestion. It's been ages since I've read Where the Dead Sit Talking, and I haven't read The Removed yet, although it's definitely on my list for sure. But that's a great recommendation, and definitely check that book out if you haven't read it. But Morgan, before we close out today, where can we find you, if anywhere, and where can we find your book?
Yeah, so my book will be out July 5th, so that's next Tuesday. It'll be in bookstores across the nation and in indie bookstores. It'll be available online, Amazon, all those big places. And if you go to my website, you can find a list of sellers. So my website's morgantalty.com. I'm on Twitter at Morgan_J_Talty. I'm on Instagram at MorganJTalty. And I'm on Facebook as well. I don't know what my Facebook hashtag thing is. I feel like it's like Morgan.
Most people aren't on Facebook anymore. I applaud you for that.
Yeah, so you can cut this out if you want to. Just it's nobody's really on there anymore. I'm on Twitter and Instagram. My book is really anywhere. I think if you Google it, most independent booksellers will be carrying it.
Absolutely. And we'll have a link to it in the show notes. So everyone definitely keep an eye out for Night of the Living Res. You know how much I like a good short story collection. And this one is definitely up there among those. And I love that you're published by Tin House too. I love Tin House. I love everything Tin House puts out. So that's definitely a plus for me. And I'm sure a plus for a lot of my listeners. And Morgan, thank you so much for your time.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you all for listening. So as a reminder, we have new episodes for the rest of this month every Thursday. Soon we'll be transitioning over to every other week. You can follow the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at YFP Podcast. Feel free to rate and review if you can. Seriously, it's much appreciated. And otherwise, have fun and happy reading.